Welcome inside the Fantasy Sports Network studios for Fantasy Sports Today. Chris Meaney, Ashley Docking here with you. And a little bit later in this show, Chris, there are a lot of alternative facts going around.
No.
So I've heard. So we're going to do our own little fantasy take on it, and we're going to play a game called Alternative Stats, and we're going to talk to some players playing above or below their threshold. A little bit after that, Derek Van Riper joins us from RotoWire.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the FSTA baseball draft that happened in Nashville, so we're going to break down his team. But first, speaking of the FSTA, Joe Pizzapia joins us now because he is an award-winning show host. Congratulations,
yes.
My friend. Taking down some FSTA awards on the radio side of things. And congratulations, as Mike Cardano said there, for your show On Target in particular.
Yeah, well done, Joe.
Well, you know, at first I want to thank the Academy. I want to thank everyone who had, I didn't get to do the big speech. I didn't get to cry and be emotional. And like Chris and I were joking before, you know, the band didn't get to play me off. But it's a huge honor to be nominated, let alone to win. And I think that Benny, Ricciardi, Jake Seeley, and myself have more fun than really we should be having every day at noon on the Fantasy Radio Network. But I think we're doing a really great job over here on the network. And it's so early in the stages, and to win an award like that was certainly surprising, maybe even shocking to us, but we're really proud of it, and we're proud of the show, and we're proud of what we're doing there.
Hey, Joe, you're used to winning, man. Number one selling author again for Fantasy Black Book. Congratulations, 2017 edition. And for those, you know, and you've done this multiple times now, but for those who, you know, haven't had a chance, Joe, to read this book, I mean, you're creator of RPV, just like talk about that and talk about, you know, what this book offers to first-timers.
Well, first of all, you lose a lot more than you win. Life is a lot like baseball like that. So when good things happen and everyone sees those good things, they don't see all the failures and all the things that didn't work and all the things that fell through and the opportunities and the situations. And you just keep grinding through all of them. So, everyone sees the success, but not always the work that comes along with that and some of the failures too. So relative position value has always been a success. It's been something I'm very proud of. It's very difficult nowadays to separate yourself from the rest of the fantasy community and the folks that you're playing and the other owners in your leagues, whether it be daily fantasy, season-long fantasy. And relative position value is really the way that, you know, you can actually separate. It's the way to evaluate talent. It's the way to make sure the talent you're drafting is appropriate for the league depth and style that you're playing. And I think that's why people really have, you know, reached out for it and have come back to it every year for the last 6 years now and made it number one every year in both football and baseball. And I think that that is a huge win for the actual theory behind it. And folks find it easy to use, and it's very simple to understand. It doesn't weigh you down with a lot of sabermetrics, but instead what it really gives you is a sense of value in the marketplace for the different kinds of formats for baseball, for football. Even within those baseball and football leagues, there's so many little different things. Is it head-to-head? Is it points? Is it roto? And that's what RPV really does. It arms you with the strength to go in, to do well in the draft, and then to manage your team throughout the entire season.
I love that you said there's no such thing as an overnight success, just a lot of all-nighters and work towards that success.
Yes.
So that's a very good point. Congratulations yet again. But we do want to talk to you a little bit about baseball, and I apologize in advance for how this is going to sound, but you are the perfect guy to talk about some non-sexy draft picks a little bit later on in the draft. And I don't mean to say that maybe you're non-sexy, but I just mean because you could do those deep dives, you can help us kind of pick and pluck some names that you might not be targeting in your drafts. And I'd like to start with Kendrys Morales signing with the Blue Jays, supposed to be DH, only played 7 games at first base last season, but then they go ahead and sign Jose Bautista, who does some DH stuff, playing in the outfield, not sure of his injuries, not sure what his status is going to be. So I'm wondering if this bringing on Jose Bautista puts you higher or lower on Morales, or it has no impact for you.
Well, up until now, I considered myself one of the sexier men in fantasy sports. Not that
and
that's
the most humble.
Not that that's
face for radio. Is that what she's saying, Joe?
Well, you know, I do have a face for radio after all. But look, as far as Kendrys Morales goes, I think that's a player that I love going over to Toronto. The Rogers Center's had a very good effect for folks. The fact that he's getting out of Kansas City is that home ballpark factor. He had a terrific season last year. I think Bautista there is going to help. I think as far as Donaldson goes, that's a guy that they needed in there when losing Encarnacion. I don't think Encarnacion leaving means Morales just slides right in and becomes exactly that player. But if he can just repeat a 30-90 season or even a 28-85 season, which I think is really the low end of a concept of projection, that's a guy who's going to do very well there. And I'm actually really bullish on Morales. I think that's a great landing spot for him. He's going to have lots of lineup protection in a really good ballpark, especially a big improvement from Kansas City. So I think Morales is a guy, don't be afraid of locking in a DH in a league. Mm-hmm. If the DH is a guy you can lock in there and leave and not think about all year and get great production. Victor Martinez, David Ortiz in the past. I am not against that concept. I don't know why people are. It's so great to have a guy you can count on every week instead of a player, or should I say a position at utility or DH, that you have to constantly be cycling in and out players trying to get the production that a Morales will give you overall season.
Sounds like you're talking about my dating wish list. Just plug someone in there you can count on instead of just recycling different guys week in and week out.
That's the dream. That's the dream.
That is the dream.
That is the dream. I don't know where to go from there. But Morales, what I liked about Morales, Joe, and you kind of touched on with the home runs, I mean, 30 last year in Kansas City, it seems like he can kind of, I don't want to say replace Edwin, but come close to it. I mean, 5 seasons with 20-plus home runs, 2 of them with 30-plus, and last year, 30 and 90. I think he can do 30 and 100. Let's move on. There's a guy who's been in the news lately, Mike Moustakas, missed most of last season with a knee injury. He said he's feeling close to 100%. This is somebody who's hit the 20-home run mark in 2 seasons, and he's got a lot of potential as well. And according to NFBC, his ADP is 196. Are you willing to take a shot on this guy? And certainly in leagues with middle and corner outfielders, deeper formats, he seems like he can help you out.
Absolutely. I think he's a terrific option as the corner infield spot. A lot of people forget how much progress Moustakas has actually made. He had 280 against lefties 2 years ago in 2015 before the injury last year, and that was a huge leap for him. A guy also who, you know, put some career highs and home runs and RBIs across the board a couple years ago, and then the injury last year was unfortunate. But when you're talking about him going around the same ADP as a guy like Nick Castellanos, who struggled mightily against lefties last year and also had a huge first half only to start to really take a dramatic fade in the second half before his injury, I don't see the two being comparable. I would much prefer Moustakas in a very deep league as a third baseman or in a shallower league as a corner guy over a guy like Castellanos, because I also think Kansas City is on that precipice of having to make a lot of hard decisions. They might be looking up in that division, and if Moustakas can move to a more favorable home ballpark in the second half of the year, that's another big positive for his value.
Yeah, I was watching his collision again with Alex Gordon.
Yeah, rough.
But it looked as though Gordon got the worst of it. Like, yeah. It looked like Moustakas kind of avoided things. Gordon broke his foot, broke his wrist, obviously.
Yeah, he missed
the
time, too.
It just was interesting because I thought it looked like it wasn't as bad as it seemed.
Rough
just
year
like,
for Kansas City. Yeah.
Rough sentence for Ashley there. Okay, let's just talk about one more guy quickly before we get you out of here. Tanner Roark. So he just signed a 1-year, $4.315 million deal. ERA sub 3 last year, 172 strikeouts and 210 innings pitched, nearly cutting his ERA by 2 points from the previous year. Is this a fluke or is this guy legit?
No, it's not a fluke at all. I wrote about Tanner Roark a couple years ago saying this is a guy you grab off the waiver wire and you can start, and he was terrific a couple years ago. He was outstanding last year, very durable. The problem is he's not sexy, to bring it back to the whole sexy conversation. I'm going to bring that conversation back here, but he isn't. And everybody always wants to draft these sexy names, these young players who really have a huge upside, but it's guys like Tanner Roark and where you get them in fantasy drafts at a huge value, they're going to win you leagues. This is a guy that pitched under a 3 ERA, a guy who pitched home and away to around a 3 ERA. He has good defense behind him, good offensive support. This is a guy who wants the ball, too. He was banished to the bullpen and was furious about it a few years ago, demanded he get another shot at the rotation. He got that. He excelled again. So for me, a guy like Tanner Roark, you know, although not the sexy name, that's a guy that's going to be a difference maker and a guy that is going to well outperform his ADP and maybe even one of the safer pitchers also when you consider the fact that he's in his prime at 30 right now. And for my money, a guy that I'm very happy in the middle of the late of my rotation in any fantasy league in any format, because he's a guy that I think I can leave in there every single week. And there's not a lot of guys around that ADP of Tanner Roark that you could say that about.
Yeah, that's fair. I like it. All right, Joe, we got to get you out of here. Thank you so, so much. Ladies and gentlemen, the sexiest man in fantasy radio, Joe Pizzapina.
Now we're getting, I like that. That's
hey, a nice music. Yo, where can people check out your book? Where can they get it?
You can go get it on iTunes and on Amazon. And for the first time ever, you can also not only get it on the Kindle store, but actually Amazon on a paperback version as well.
Nice.
All right, Joe, they're playing us out. We got to go. See you later.
See you later, Joe. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we'll be back on FSD. Playing a little name that tune during the break here on FST, and I will say camera one is the worst at trying to give out melodies and make you guess. Thank you for joining us on FST. We are presenting some alternative stats, some numbers that present and represent non-truths for better or for worse. A little bit of a play on a buy low, sell high, if you will, but for all intents and purposes, alternative stats is what we are calling it. We're gonna start with Eric Bledsoe, and I just told Chris in the break, I changed my mind about him.
That's not Eric Bledsoe.
I just changed my mind about him. Okay, so in the last 10 games prior to their blowout against Memphis, they got blown out, just for the record. Two 40-point games, two 30-point games, one 28-point game against Denver. So his average is 26 points per game. But as you see here on the season, 21.5 points per game is his average. Now, I think that the 40, the 30 is a little bit above his threshold, but I think that he is actually playing below what he could be. I think you should be able to expect around 25 points per game. And you were saying a few years ago, he was a touch-em-all kind of guy. So although these numbers are inflated, I think he's still actually playing worse than he will be.
Well, you see there, like the at least five rebounds, at least five assists per game. He does touch all categories. And you're right, before Ashley, he had some significant injuries. He was like a triple double threat. You see the steal and a half, the half a block a game. So like he can hit all categories. So I'm with you. I like Bledsoe. I don't think he's a 40 point guy. I don't think we're going to see that too often, but there's not a lot of great players in Phoenix where he can, if he wants to do that from time to time, given the matchup, Memphis is tough, given the matchup against other teams, so he can go off like that. He does have that potential.
Yeah, people are going to see the 14 points against Memphis after dropping 41 and just inverting the numbers. They're like, oh, it was a flash in the pan. Maybe. So try and see if someone's down on him. See if they're not willing to ride that wave, because I think Bledsoe is someone that is going to be very good coming back from a meniscus injury, just tearing it up. All right, I knew this was going to happen. Ivica Zubac.
Ivica
Zubac, okay? Center for the Los Angeles Lakers, has played the last three games and has double-doubled twice.
Ivica Zubac.
We like him.
Huge. He's 92% free throw percentage from the line. That's great for a big man, a center. You know, honestly, Ashley, you're right. I'm glad I'm glad you brought this guy up, because we should bring him
up.
He's available in leagues. Luke Walton said he expects him to be. Imagine messing up Luke Walton. he's expected to be in the starting lineup soon. He had back-to-back games with double-doubles. He played almost the entire fourth quarter last night. If you're in need of just some upside, if you're in a keeper league, in a dynasty league, you know, this guy tore it up in the summer league, so I don't think it's any fluke. I think he's a terrific talent.
He's 19 years young. He's going to have those growing pains. He's going to have times where you're like, oh, that was probably a bad decision. But in four games where he's played at least 20 minutes, he has three double-doubles. He's legit. High field goal percentage, as you mentioned. High free throw percentage. He does some really nice things. I want to touch on Norman Powell quickly. This is a sell high candidate for me. DeMar DeRozan dealing with some ankle injuries when he's not playing. Norman Powell is a great option. Dwayne Casey does trust him, but there's just no room for him in the rotation when DeMar DeRozan is in. They are very, very heavy at the guard position, the Toronto Raptors, and Norman Powell is a highlight reel, just a walking highlight reel. So I think that you can capitalize that if you have him and sell him, flip him for something that's going to be a bit more consistent.
Yeah, I agree. I echo your comments. I mean, he was so good in the playoffs in the first round. I mean, and it's actually been kind of disappointing to see him be just mediocre. But I mean, given the playing time and the opportunities, you know, he hasn't really done what I thought he could do. I think it's just been mediocre. So I think he's a good ball player. But yeah, if you have him, you can try to flip him.
Send someone a link to his dunk against Anthony Davis last night, and then offer them a trade and say that, do you want this guy? He's very athletic. Okay, Joe Thornton, three goals, all coming on empty nets.
What is going on with Jumbo
Joe? A little bit
deceiving. Three goals? Yeah.
32 points, though, but...
But that's not good enough. So, yeah, you see the points.
Yeah.
So 32 points in 51 games played, 13 power play points. They're all assists, of course. It's just the shooting percentage that they go to. And Joe Thornton's never been a goal scorer, really. I mean, he hasn't scored 20 goals, you know, since 2010. But he has always been a point-per-game guy. And those 32 points in 51 games are just not good enough. But I go to his shooting percentage. It's at 6%. For his career, it's at 13%. It's always been hovering around that mark over the past few years. So I expect him actually in the second half of the season to be more of a point-per-game guy. We talked about Thomas Hertl yesterday coming back in the lineup. He was placed in that top line with the Joes, and he scored a goal. Not Thornton, Hertl. So just for Thornton, I mean, look at the point. 65 and 78, 76 and 88, yeah. 40 and 48, 77 and 82. We're used to seeing a point-per-game production from him, so I think we'll see that in the second half when the Sharks amp things up. You know, they were the Western Conference champs last year.
So you're saying just because he's 37 years old,
yeah,
you can still trust him. Don't believe these numbers. They are alternative stats.
Yeah, I expect the goals to come.
He's a name brand. He's on a team that's a top seed in the West all the time, and I know we have to get out of here, but sorry, Raj. Michael Grabner, just quickly, I really want to get your thoughts
on
him.
Yeah, yeah. Grabner. It's a joke what he's doing right now. I can't believe it. I mean, this guy, he had 30 goals a season in 2010, 2011 playing with John Tavares. He plays like 12, 13 minutes a game. And already, you see the goals there, 22 goals. I just can't believe he's doing this. And then you look at the shooting percentage again, and it's a good stat to look at when guys are, you know, not scoring as much or they're scoring a lot. 21%, that's what the shooting percentage at, is the sixth highest mark in the NHL for his career. He's 12%. So I just temper expectations. I think you could flip him. There's always a Rangers fan in leagues. Go ahead and trade him.
Target the Rangers fan. Know your opponents. It's your best weapon. We're going to see if Derek Van Riper knew his opponents when he was involved in the FSTA draft and if that affected his strategy. That's coming up on FST. This is Fantasy Sports Today. Time to change gears, and we're going to talk about the FSTA baseball draft that happened just last week. Chris Meaney was there. We talked about his team already, but we're going to bring in Derek Van Riper now from RotoWire to talk about his team, his draft strategy, and if he's actually happy with his results. Derek, you had the seventh pick in a 13-team league. How do you think it went?
You know, I think it went pretty well this year, guys. I like being in the middle of the draft, the way it sets up right now in a league this size. If it were 15 teams, being at seven may have been a little more challenging, but I didn't really get caught up in any positional runs. I was able to get good balance on my roster throughout. I didn't really feel like I missed out on any key positions or key categories. So hindsight, feeling pretty good about where I drafted and the team I put together.
Sounding like a real GM that's taken some media classes.
Yeah, no, Derek, I really like your squad. I wanted to start with Kershaw at the top, and you mentioned you picked seventh. Going into the draft, did you feel like, you know, that was the goal, like you were going to get Kershaw if he was available to you? And I guess if he wasn't, I mean, who were you looking at?
Yeah, I figured Paul Goldschmidt would be the hitter most likely to fall. I mean, Trout, Betts, Altuve, Arenado, and Bryant were all going to be gone before seven. I just kind of figured it was between Goldschmidt and Kershaw. When Goldschmidt went five, I knew it was either going to be Chris Bryant or Kershaw. So I'd spent some time thinking about it on the way to Nashville on Monday. And you think about building around Kershaw. This is a guy with three-year averages of a 186 ERA, an 083 whip, 237 strikeouts. And when you build around him, even in a snake draft, it just opens up so much flexibility with the other pitching spots. I know he missed time in 2014 in addition to last year with back injuries. So we've got two out of the last 3 years where he's failed to reach 200 innings. But this is the kind of player that the dollar value in auctions on Kershaw exceeds the value of some of the hitters that we draft ahead of him. So I think people stay away from him in part because he's a pitcher and in part because of the injury risk. I certainly acknowledge the latter, but I have no problem building around Kershaw as a mid-first round pick this year.
Yeah, you can't draft in fear, man. You can't be like, they might get hurt, because everyone might get hurt. You never know what's going to happen. I'm interested. So you were one of two players that drafted a starting pitcher in the first round. Four other teams waited until the fifth round. Dr. Roto waited until the eighth round to take his first starter and then went back-to-back Aaron Sanchez and then went Roberto Osuna after. How do you feel about that strategy? Like, if you weren't able to get one of the top three pitchers that you wanted, if you were like the last pick in the draft, would you have waited, or would you have tried to shore up that position immediately?
I think it's really top heavy this year. So if I don't get one of the top five starting pitchers, I might be inclined to wait. But I think rather than do what Dr. Roto did, I wouldn't wait quite that long. I would do what Todd Zola and Lar Michaels did. They were drafting from the third position. I think in round six, they took Carlos Carrasco. And round eight, they took Danny Duffy. So they didn't go quite as thin. They got two guys who could emerge to be legitimate number one fantasy starters. There's just so little to separate the sixth starting pitcher on the board from the 16th, especially. But I think you can even bring that down to like the 25th overall pitcher. I think there's a pretty narrow gap in terms of the skills you're getting. So I'm comfortable waiting on starting pitching, but I wouldn't wait much longer than round six or so to get that first one.
I am so thoroughly impressed that you just knew Carrasco and Duffy like that. Like, do you have like a secret Google Glass or something going on? Jeez, very impressive.
It's good stuff. He's got this draft down pat. I, again, with strategy questions, you know, you got Kershaw. Did that make your strategy change at all with the relievers? Because, I mean, you got two of the top three that went off the board, and Kenley Jansen and Zach Britton. I mean, Jansen you took in round four, Britton you took in round seven. Clearly, I don't have these memorized as you do, because Jansen was actually in the fifth round. But for those relievers, it's so hard to chase saves. You don't have to do that now, but was that your strategy? You know, getting a guy like Kershaw made you feel like, I don't have to get another top pitcher, I'm going to get two top closers?
You know, it wasn't predetermined to the point where I was going to do it at all costs, but I think as I saw the hitters coming off the board in round four and the start of round five, Jansen popped up as my best available player, and it just made sense to go ahead and start off with one elite closer to back up Kershaw, because I could wait a little longer to start filling in to get those ratios that I need. I like Kenley Jansen just a little more than Aroldis Chapman, in part because of the way Joe Girardi uses Dellin Betances. I don't think Dave Roberts is going to use any of his other relievers to take away save chances from Jansen, so that's why I think he's a slightly better option. I mean, this is a guy, Kenley Jansen, that would likely have four consecutive 100 strikeout seasons if it weren't for that foot injury that he had in 2015. So I think, like Kershaw, you're getting outstanding ratios, you're getting a good K rate, you're getting an extremely stable arm. And it just so happened, I made a joke about it at the time, because I know that taking a closer in round five of an industry draft is a little bit of a reach. I said at the time, if I have to watch other people wait two rounds before they get Chapman and Britton, they get the elite closers two rounds later, I'm going to feel like a real idiot. Yeah. I was the one that got Britton two rounds later. So, I mean, I guess I got some of the value that I was worried about. And doing that really opened up strategy even further, because I could punt even harder on the bottom of my pitching staff. I mean, in the 13-team mixed league, part of the strategy I had once I had Kershaw was that I was going to have at least two spots at the bottom of my pitching staff that are going to be streaming options off the waiver wire throughout the season.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. The little security and then the punt plays. You got to love it. I want to pull it back a little bit, though, and just go to round two. Trey Turner, the 20th overall pick, is on your team. Congratulations, sir. However, there is some concern that although he had a huge breakout year, that there may be some regression. So do you think 20th overall was a bit of a reach and you just really wanted to have him on your team for ceiling, or you're comfortable where you got him?
Yeah, 20 overall is closer to where I have him ranked, and I'm lower on Trey Turner than most people, so it's a little surprising that in the first draft we're doing that counts that I actually have him. Mm-hmm. He's not a guy that I want at the end of round one, necessarily. I was torn between Turner and Edwin Encarnacion in that pick, and they do very different things, but in the moment, it just seemed like it'd be a lot easier to find players like Encarnacion in subsequent rounds, but there's not really another player like Turner on the board. I think worst case scenario, he's kind of like Starling Marte, who Jeff Manns took in early round two, and Manns was the other guy that took a pitcher in round one. I think you're going to get a good average, probably closer to 280 or 290. He could hit 300 again, but the BABIP was off the charts last year for Turner, so you're probably giving back 40 or 50 points worth of batting average. I think he scaled back the home runs slightly. He did some damage against really low-level big league pitching last season. Mm-hmm. But even if he gets 8 or 10 home runs, I think he steals 40 bases easily, and he might steal 50 to 60. So you factor those in with the runs scored, the good batting average, and even a good number of RBIs for a guy at or near the top of a lineup. Trey Turner looks like the kind of player that has a really high floor despite having a very limited track record in the big leagues.
All right. I like it. You've sold me.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a perfect spot where he went, for sure.
All right. We got to get out of here. Wave goodbye to everybody. We're out of here. Thanks for joining us
Take
on
care,
FFT.
Derek.
We'll see you again tomorrow.
See you, bye.
Thanks, guys.